everyone. I'm Emmeline Pat Dahlstrom from Spacebase, a social enterprise focused on catalyzing the space entrepreneurial ecosystem starting in New Zealand to solve challenges on Earth and beyond. You're listening to the Spacebase podcast. Today, I'm interviewing Christian Talerwolski. Christian is a startup advisor, business developer, and angel investor focused on space tech. Previously, Christian worked in venture capital in Europe. Prior to his investor role, he has a five-year career in technical product sales and key account management at Oracle, a global leader in enterprise software. Christian is a native of Germany and graduated from the International Space University's Southern Hemisphere Space Studies Program in 2020. He has degrees in economics and also a graduate of an MBA degree at INSEAD in Fontainebleau in 2006. Christian moved to Adelaide in 2019, and subsequently, he co-founded the ISU Alumni Association for Australia and New Zealand, as well as the ISU Adelaide Conference, held every year online for the whole Indo-Pacific region. Welcome, Christian.
Hi, Emmeline. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast. So you moved from Europe to the Pacific region about a few years ago, and you know, you started the ISU Adelaide Space Conference, as well as the ISU Alumni Association for Australia and New Zealand. You've also invested in a number of space startup companies, but let's start from the very beginning. So you were born in Germany, but before you pursued a career in space industry, I mean, as a kid, what were you generally interested in growing up, since you've got bachelor's in economics?
That's a good question. Yeah, I know a lot of space people have these amazing stories about their, you know, about their fascination of space and how they became you know, interested in space, and I have to admit I didn't. You know, I was just an average kid. I grew up in Berlin and Germany, and I've been always a bit of a generalist. So that's one reason why I studied international economics, because it was sort of, for me, it was a way of understanding how the world works and being able to read the Financial Times from first page to last page and understanding everything, whether it's the political economy, finance, the markets, etc. But in hindsight, I have to admit, there's probably better ways to spend your undergrad in engineering or something else. But what I did then is I did join Oracle, the big enterprise software company, and in a sales role for database products. So over the years, I did learn all the acronyms, all the enterprise software architecture, and worked with banks in Germany, so financial services institutions. And then over time, I worked my way further into what you could call technology. So first I got an MBA, I suppose back then, this is what a lot of people did. Probably now, there's other ways of gaining similar experience, but back then I got an MBA, and then I joined a venture capital fund in Germany. Actually, first I joined a startup, that was about a year and a half, but then I joined a venture capital fund, and this was my first exposure, you know, really diving into entrepreneurship, into funding entrepreneurship, entrepreneurial finance, and how startups grow over time or sometimes don't.
So yeah, as an aside, you seem to have gotten around quite well with like traveling all around, because as I see your, you know, your degrees were done in Hungary and in Canada, and of course you did your MBA in France. So, how did those opportunities came about?
I knew that I wanted to study internationally and see as much as I could at that time. And some of it was a bit opportunistic. For example, Canada was a time I had a couple. I lived in Budapest at the time, and I studied at the International Study Center of the leading economics university there, in English. And some of my friends were Canadian, and they went back to Canada. So I was like, I want to go to Canada too. and then I spent a year in Toronto, and I loved it there. Toronto is a great place. It was back then, at the time, this is late 90s, probably the most multicultural place I'd ever seen in my life. And I loved every bit of it there. And actually then I spent here in Colorado, in the United States. I was then in Dublin in Ireland, where I started working for Oracle. And then I moved into the Oracle country organization in Germany and subsequently worked for about 3 years there. So in total, 5 years at Oracle, almost 5 years. But yeah, so I left Berlin in 1995 and I didn't return to Germany until like 2001 or 2002. And
So when you say that it's opportunistic, you know, so what did you have that made all of those opportunities happen? Actually, I mean, is it connections? Is it grades? Or is it just the right background?
No, it was really, I come from a middle-class family. It was more a desire to see the world. I grew up in East Berlin. I guess you could say the wrong side of the Berlin Wall. And so I wanted to see as much as I could. Actually, I spent a year in high school in the US. This is in the early 1990s. Went back to Berlin, completed my secondary school there. And then I just wanted to just get out there again. First station was Budapest in Hungary, then Canada, then Colorado, then Ireland. Sorry, it's such a long time ago. But yeah, no, I just wanted to see as much as I could. And so it was a combination of study abroad, self sort of organized study abroad, working abroad, and then coming back to Germany. And then years later, again, I had that feeling that I wanted to make a move. And that's when I actually went to New Zealand first for a couple months, but then settled on Australia. Even though I really like New Zealand as a destination, I found my calling in Adelaide then in 2019.
I see. You were saying earlier that you transitioned over to basically investing and advising. So how did that came about? Just for the benefit of the audience, because most people really don't know how, you know, investors get started.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And over the years I've been mentoring and speaking at many opportunities and occasions about that. So I joined my first, you know, VC fund as an associate, basically like, you know, one of the analysts working for the partners and the portfolio companies in 2008. And at that time, this was just basically getting right into the, you know, great financial crisis, at the GFC. At that time, we were lucky because the fund that I joined had just raised a new VC fund. So they had fresh money to deploy. And because I worked in a startup before, I kind of knew what the VCs were looking for in terms of, you know, basically the right answers to their questions. And so I aced the interview and got accepted in one of the roles as an analyst there. Then I, you know, changed roles, went to a different VC fund that was a bit bigger, a bit more international in their way of operating. So I got to travel all over Europe, attend a lot of conferences and scout investment opportunities, mostly in the realm of enterprise software, software as a service, cloud technologies, etc. And spoke to a lot of entrepreneurs, looked at a lot of business plans, and then, you know, gradually you go from analyzing business plans to actually sort of architecting the funding rounds, you know, pulling in co-investors, angel investors, and being able to add that, you know, extra value that hopefully most VCs should be adding. That was a great time. I did one more switch to another VC fund that was in 2015, 16 in Berlin. And then I went solo for a couple of years, just worked for myself, advised a few companies. Some of them are, you know, great names like Hotjar, Localize, mostly application layer B2B SaaS. And this was the time when I got when I had my first space deal, like my first company that came to me somehow in my deal flow, that was a space company. And it was one of those downstream application companies extracting data from satellite imagery using machine learning algorithms, computer vision, pattern recognition, CVPR algorithms. And it was one of those stories from back then, which we've all heard, you know, where they count cars on the Walmart parking lot and these kind of things, where they measure the floating roofs in the oil reservoir containers in port cities and ports. And but it was all about being automating that and using machine learning, right? So you could do it at scale. And that was fascinating because this was 2017. And it was the first time that I really started looking into, you know, the role space generated data played, how it worked with Earth observation satellites, et cetera. And then really one thing came after another. A year later, there was a space consulting firm in Munich called Space Tech Partners working on one of those big reports for the European Commission on access to finance for space companies. And I basically co-authored a couple of the chapters in that report. It's one of those 120 pages, you know, lots of diagrams, lots of things that they looked at. And I looked at how the venture capital model would need to be sort of adapted to deep tech and space tech. And that was the first time that I really had someone comprehensively explain to me, you know, space technologies. And I spent a couple months in their office in Munich, and they have all these smart consultants that, you know, told me about these various programs in Europe, but also, you know, the space technology side of things, Copernicus, etc. And that was sort of the next step in my space career, if you will. Out of that came another step, which was in 2019, the New Zealand Space Agency ran one of their grant programs. I think it was called Space Catalyst. It's Catalyst program, right? It was six grants worth $500,000 each. And I got picked as one of the four or five assessors on that panel. And one reason was because they wanted someone who was, you know, from outside the New Zealand space bubble. The other reason is I came from the commercial perspective. Everyone else was technologists, which was great, but they also wanted a diversity in opinions from the commercial side of things. And the interesting thing there was that for the first time, I was looking at a lot of technologies that were either upstream or in orbit that, you know, again, I didn't have much of an idea about, which I freely admitted, but I spent a lot of time catching up on it and reading up on it. So they had budgeted a certain amount of hours per grant application that the reviewers would be compensated for. I probably beat that by five times because I was reading up on everything, but it was a great way of, you know, educating myself. And that's where I decided I had to come to a point where I decided to, you know, either do this for real or not. And I decided to do it for real. It sort of coincided with my relocation to Adelaide. And as some of your listeners will know, ISU, International Space University, runs the Southern Hemisphere program in Adelaide every year. So I signed up for that in January, February 2020. I joined the Southern Hemisphere Space Studies Program in Adelaide, SHSSP. So yeah, that's the fast forward going from 2017, looking at my first space deal, to seeing subsequently a lot more space investment opportunities, of course, but also working on, you know, a consulting gig, multiple consulting gigs, and then getting deeper into it and finally getting that comprehensive introduction into space through the International Space University program, becoming an alum and then, you know, running various events.
Maybe if you can give a little bit more of an understanding for the audience of what the program is all about.
Yeah, sure. So the SHSSP program, or again, Southern Hemisphere Space Studies Program, we like our abbreviations and acronyms in the space industry. SHSSP is a 5-week, call it professional development program, co-created by the International Space University in partnership with University of South Australia in Adelaide. And the idea behind that program is that participants get a full view on all things space. So it includes everything from understanding space systems engineering to deep space science to space medicines, astrobiology, space law, and other things that play into you know, having a full 360 degree view on space. Now, obviously, a 5-week program is not the same as a master's degree, but actually, International Space University does offer that as well. So if you want, you could also do the master's degree program, which is hosted at the headquarter in Strasbourg, where the ISU is headquartered. But yeah, so the 5-week program is a super intensive program. It's structured in a way where you have, I think it's 3 hours of academic instruction every day from world-class lecturers. So for example, the chief scientist of NASA, Jim Green, came to our program for 1 week and he taught, I think, 3 lectures, everything on deep space science, you know, formation of the stars, life cycle of the stars, etc. And this is someone who's got a great overview of all the NASA missions that go into deep space. So this is someone, you know, spent decades in that massive institution and knows everything about it. And another person that joined us from NASA is John Connolly, who's a senior manager at NASA in space systems engineering. So he's been responsible for lunar landers and, you know, deep space devices and probes. And he was our lecturer on space systems engineering, for example. Yeah, so that program then is complemented, or this academic lectures is complemented by workshops of various kinds. We had a workshop on building a stratospheric balloon, launching that balloon, and then getting data from the payload on that balloon, which was one camera looking forward, one camera looking downward. And then we overlaid that data with images, also that image with satellite imagery that we got from freely available satellite imagery. So we combined sort of a launch a balloon with all the regulatory hurdles and the physics of that balloon with an Earth observation workshop, for example. Other people build model rockets and launch them, and then various other workshops. So it's a great, super intensive course, 5 weeks, round about 50 participants. And when you're done with it, you have a new family because you spend so much time together.
Yeah, and so now that you're an alumni of the program, was that the reason or why you were compelled to co-found the Alumni Association for the region?
Yeah, that was definitely part of it. But the first thing that we did is a couple of people had run a very local ISU conference at the time when I was participant in the program. So there were a couple of people in Adelaide. And then the next year, you know, it was the first year of COVID. So our program was just before COVID sort of happened, right? COVID was emerging at the time, January, February 2020, but it wasn't really a thing yet until a few months later. And when the next program rolled around, it was moved online. And so we decided, hey, well, we're going to, you know, do the ISU Adelaide conference online. And we very quickly discovered that there's actually, you know, quite a market for online. And there's a bit of a gap also in terms of online well-run space conferences. Here in the region, specifically here in the region, what we call the Indo-Pacific region. So in February 2021, we ran that conference for the first time online. It was huge fun. We had a very little budget and we made it a great success. And then subsequently, we ran the next conference again in February 2022. So just a few months ago. This time we had a bit more budget available, a few more sponsors, and we focused entirely on space debris. And because we want to get more people involved and people who are outside the space industry, we wanted to make it a bit more punchy. So we called it the Space Junk Conference instead of the more professional term space debris. It was great success.
And so there's another one coming up, right?
Yeah. And so we have a new conference coming up that we're organizing right now. Last year, we had for the first time, we had a few what I called celebrity speakers. So Moriba Ja, who's, you know, famous in the space debris community. He was one of our speakers, but also many others. Companies like Astroscale were involved. and speakers who contributed specifically to that topic, like Alice Gorman, for example, from Adelaide, who's Dr. Space Junk on Twitter. She's a space archaeologist, but also Chris Kunstetter, who is global head of AXA XL Insurance. So he knows everything about insuring spacecraft in LEO, right? So that's a big deal, but also LEO Labs, which is a space radar company tracking objects in LEO, and one of their managing directors here in Australia, Terry Van Heeren, he was speaking at our conference. So we had really, really good people, and we had sort of elevated the profile of the conference, and now we're planning for the next one.
And what's the theme for the next one?
Yeah, so the theme for the next conference is commercial space. And the idea behind that topic is to highlight the opportunities, but also challenges of commercial space activities, as opposed to everything that's sort of government and space agency driven missions. So we really want to look at sort of that 1 degree or more further away from government to how is a privately run space companies, how's that evolving, and exploring the business opportunities and a broad range of topics. So it could be, you know, whether it's human spaceflight by SpaceX, but also mission control run by private companies, potentially, you know, what can a future in-orbit economy look like, where's the money, etc. Also from a space policy perspective, you know, space agencies, whether they have their own, whether they're their own, you know, missions, or whether they're commissioning missions to others, how is that going to change if we're moving to a model where they need to interact with flexible and agile sort of fail fast type of startup approaches, as opposed to multi-billion dollar government projects. So that's some of the things we're going to look at. And then we try to make room also for, obviously, from an ethical perspective, how is that going to work with a private or privatized space economy? Where, how is it going to work with potential land grab or spectrum squatting and these kind of things from a regulatory perspective? We want to look at space entertainment, even, you know, VR experiences in space, games. There is a company out of Japan called ALE that wants to do artificial shooting stars, which I find fascinating. When you know, have a theater of maybe 200 kilometers where you can observe artificial shooting stars. So there's a lot of things we can look at. We always want to tie it back to entrepreneurship, because at the end of the day, if companies are privately run, it's going to have to be, or going to be, in an entrepreneurial way. And so who are the entrepreneurs behind these companies who make that happen?
Awesome. And so what are the dates and how can they sign up?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's on the 3rd of February and the 4th of February. And the model that we've tested over the last couple of years is it's going to be online. Very high production value for an online experience. About 9 hours of content. The first day is about 3 hours, which is the Friday. And the second day is about 6 hours, which is the Saturday. And we'll have, again, a couple really keynote speakers. We'll have a couple space agencies involved, whether India, Philippines, New Zealand, Australia, Japan, and entrepreneurs, etc. The website is adelaide.isunet.edu, and there's also Humanitics, which is sort of like an Eventbrite booking page. It's very low price. Students can get a free complimentary pass, and at this point, it's a great time to sign up. We're also going to have an in-person welcome reception in Adelaide. You know, current situation in COVID allows us to do that, so we will have an in-person event in Adelaide, but the two events are sort of separate. So there's the online event, which is purely run for an online audience, and then we'll have an in-person event here in Adelaide. So if you can come to Adelaide, it would be a great time to do so.
Awesome. Looking forward to the next conference. So during that time, as you mentioned, it kind of like became sort of an inflection point for you to really focus on space tech. But besides, you know, being able to understand much better the industry and seeing how where it's going and what opportunities are, why in particular did you think that, you know, that you were just going to be focusing on space tech as opposed to, you know, like a broader portfolio?
Yeah, so this is probably something where I really saw that, I mean, space obviously is an, you know, decade old industry, and a lot of people, you know, study aerospace engineering and spend all their life in space agencies working on various space missions, which is fantastic. I didn't have that privilege, but I came late to the space industry, but I really basically pivoted. I changed careers, going from what you could call general tech and the investment side of it, or the finance side and the business side of it, going, doing the same thing, but focused on space tech. So now what I do is I still advise space or startups. I still advise VC funds, venture capital funds, and I do my own advisory business in that sense, but more focused on space. And I can only recommend anyone that is not yet part of the space industry to really take a hard look and whether they can apply their skills from whatever industry they're in, whether they can apply that in the space industry, because not everyone has to be a space engineer in order to work in the space industry, right? The space industry also needs business development managers. It needs communications people. It needs HR people. It needs professional services of all kinds, and salespeople that understand about space, but don't necessarily have to be a space engineer or space scientist. And I think that's really where the space industry is now at an inflection point in many countries, not just Australia, where that is the case. And that rapid growth needs to be fueled. And people transitioning in their mid-careers, in their 30s or even 40s, into that industry is absolutely, you know, legitimate.
Yeah. So with your investor hat on, what do you think is, or what is your opinion on how the investment landscape is for the space sector, like today, compared to like a few years ago?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's, when you look at the market, there is a lot of things that are happening, and some of it is more noisy. Other things are more happening in the quiet. Certainly as the whole startup industry or startups as a whole have had this massive momentum over the last couple of years, that now has, you know, been a bit dampened, or in some cases, in some industries, in some particular cases, has come crashing down as part of an, you know, economic cycle that's stopped working. But fact of the matter is that there's been a great run in anything that has to do with downstream applications, what I mentioned earlier. But that then started companies in upstream and hardware technologies, deep tech, that have much longer development cycles, need much more money in order to come to a point where they can prove something. And those companies started getting money as well. Some of them, you know, it takes longer, it's harder, and the amounts are not as large, but some of them have raised massive amounts of funding, right? And in the US, that came, it was very evident. And then the way all these companies went public through the so-called SPACs, that was in a phase which was fascinating to watch. Personally, I didn't participate in any of that. I'm much more conservative in that respect, but I did do a couple smaller investments in companies. One of them is called Hio Robotics out of Sydney. What they do is they use existing Earth observation cameras that are in orbit in order to image other spacecraft. So they retask effectively a supplier satellite, an existing satellite, in order to take an image of a customer satellite. And they do that successfully. They have demonstrated that. They have a couple dozen cameras now in orbit actively, and it works. And to me, that made a lot of sense in LEO. It potentially, of course, could also work in GEO. And so I believe that they have you know, a good future. And they got there in a very bootstrap way. They're very frugal, where I saw that the, you know, money was valued. And then what I called an asset-light business model by using existing cameras that, you know, as we all know, EO cameras often have up to 70% downtime, or they're not being used, idle time, because, you know, it's either at night or they're not over the right area. So there's a lot of ways to retask the satellite and use them for these other short interim missions.
Yeah.
So that's just one example of a company I found fascinating, and I was able to participate in one of their funding rounds. And so, yeah, I look at companies, some of them, you know, in other countries, some of them larger funding rounds where I'm just able to help with maybe a couple of investor introductions. It's been fascinating to see that in Y Combinator, which is probably the best accelerator in the world, has had a number of space tech companies in the last couple of cohorts. And that is always an indicator to me that these things have arrived in investor mainstream, because more and more non-space people in the investment side get exposure to these kind of companies. Yeah. So someone like Turion Space, Transastra, and others have participated in that. Actually, also Hero Robotics in Y Combinator. And so more and more space investors get exposure to that. They see, you know, companies that, if successful, can make, you know, massive dent in that, and that's what's happening. That's great.
For sure. And why do you think that there is a little bit of a change of heart between, like, the traditional investors who normally would not touch space because it's way too risky, and are now beginning to actually start funding this space specific companies?
Well, there's probably a few things that are coming together, and we're still very early in that cycle, but three major things. One is the cost of doing business in space has come down, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's through, you know, SpaceX and the way, you know, dollars per kilogram have come down to put things into orbit, massively come down, but also other ways of prototyping hardware, whether it's 3D printing and other sophisticated additive manufacturing technologies. The availability of data, whether it's space-generated data, but also tracking things in orbit, right? All these databases have now become more available for what you could call general use. So it's not classified anymore. It's not hidden anymore. It's become much more transparent. So all of that calls entrepreneurs into, like, external or into the space industry that are now trying their hands at space tech ventures. On the other hand, we have entrepreneurship as a mainstream aspiration becoming more viable to, you know, people who might not have considered such a career path 10 years ago. Yeah. So aerospace engineers working on their PhD, working on something interesting. You know, in the past, they would have joined a space agency. They would have joined a research institute. They might have joined a prime, right? But now becoming an entrepreneur is actually an option, because there's so many role models. There's so much help out there, whether it's, you know, incubator programs, accelerator programs, general entrepreneurship education programs. All of that is happening. And that encourages a lot of people, these, let's say, PhD in aerospace engineering, some discipline or science, to say, hey, you know, I can actually do this. So that's number two. And number three is that we have a lot of investors, what I mentioned earlier, that are more comfortable with space tech. You could say that has various reasons as well. One is a lot of the past decade was shaped by cloud technologies, software as a service, et cetera, seeing massive investments. I mean, billions of dollars, hundreds of billions, actually. Creating trillions of dollars of enterprise value. Not saying that has run its course, but a lot of people are now looking for what's the next thing. And the next thing in, again, various disciplines is deep tech. And space tech, to me and many other people, is sort of a sub segment of deep tech. And that means that a lot more investors are now looking at what are the real technologies changing the world? What can help us in, you know, combating climate change, cleaning up the oceans, or, you know, this and that. So things that take more time and development that very often are built on the back of science or real R&D. And these investors are now more prominent, or they've, you know, there's more of them and they have more money available. And that is a function of why we're seeing more space tech investments getting funding that maybe 10 years ago wouldn't have gotten the funding. So if you take these three things combined, plus, you know, a couple more other adjacent things, all of that together creates a momentum that you can't really stop anymore. Even an economic downturn like the one we have right now, it's not going to stop it, yeah, because technologies will still develop. In fact, the greatest companies are founded often in economic downturn cycles. Mm. Great entrepreneurs, they will still start their companies. Money is still available. So all of that means that even though the next 12 months might be tough, there are still going to be companies that are getting funded. And once we come out of that economic downturn, these companies are going to, you know, get into full swing and be able to execute. And yes, it's going to take longer than the average SaaS company, and it might take more money, and it might be a more binary outcome. But the ones that are successful will be creating massive value. And whether that's, you know, privatized space stations or another EO constellation, another remote sensing constellation, IoT constellation, or even private lunar rovers, that's not the point. What mm-hmm. I'm making, the point is it's happening.
Yeah. Oh, that's so awesome to hear, actually, and especially coming from, you know, the perspective of those who are actually funding this endeavors and and companies. So my last set of questions is actually more about recommendations from you personally. So what would you recommend someone, kind of like the first steps, if they wanted to follow sort of a career path in space investing or advising like you have?
Good question. Probably a good way is various ways or angles to explore this. One is from a networking side of things. So you just attend a lot of conferences, whether online or in-person events, and you build a network. And at some point, you re-meet people, you see them over and over again, and you start making friendships, etc. The other side is understanding more the policy perspective, or also topics, you know, how does spectrum work? How is it assigned? You know, how is launch regulation? How does it work? What are the economics of launch? And these kind of things. So you become a, you know, more knowledgeable in things. What I did after I attended ISU, I spent a couple months actually building my own database of venture-backed startups, because I was talking about it all the time, but I didn't really know, because the existing databases like Crunchbase, et cetera, weren't good enough. So I built my own in order to be able to, you know, with authority say, you know, this is the amount of money that went into space tech in a particular segment of the market or country. And if you want to do that, then you should probably, you know, whatever your angle is, but you need to spend a couple, probably 100 hours on it in getting your way into that. Another thing is you could get on it from just the general investing side, you know, focused on venture capital or angel investments. And then you narrow it down in terms of the topics, in terms of what you like, and whether it's downstream data applications, whether it's, you know, precision navigation, whether it's applications for primary industries like ag tech or something like agriculture, space for agriculture, space for, you know, marine, like fisheries or whatever, or whether you're actually interested in, you know, in orbit structures, whether it's, you know, manufacturing in zero gravity environments, or hotels in space, or whatever it is, right? Just start wrapping your head around it, research the internet, talk to people in conferences, and then form sort of an investment hypothesis. You know, it doesn't have to be very detailed, but it should be a bit of a framework that you then can explore further and refine over time.
That's really a great insight and recommendation. Yeah. Do you have any, you know, favorite resources or books or even online kind of platforms that you actually use at all?
Yeah, there's a few podcasts on Spotify that you could, you know, discover. There's Raphael Rutgen's Space Business Podcast is great, but there's others, and they're great ways of, you know, just hearing other opinions of, you know, educating yourself, etc. So, yeah.
So, yeah, before we close, do you have any general food for thought or recommendations for anyone here listening today?
Yeah, I think what I didn't know is when I joined ISU is that when you come out, you've really found in your family. It sounds, you know, maybe a bit cheesy, but it's true. And that one reason why I spend a lot of time on alumni activity and creating events here in Australia for the entire region is because it's so much fun and you have so much energy and so many people coming together and contributing to this that I really didn't have in another industry before. It's a lot more collaborative. It's a lot more mutual. So yeah, it's just a lot of fun, and ISU is a great platform for that.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Christian, for sharing your experience and insights to the New Zealand community and beyond. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you like Space Base's work and would like to support us, please check it out at spacebase.co. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
Thank you, Emily. Thanks.